and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at.
To me, compared to the Save America Act, just about everything is a big yawn.
A bipartisan effort to combat the country's housing issues, but President Trump stalls on signing it. A look at what the bill would do. What do you hope people take away from your life story?
Help one another.
And remembering the pioneering Chicago businessman and founder of Johnson Products Company, George Johnson. First off tonight, five people were killed and 23 others were shot over the holiday weekend in Chicago, making it the city's least violent 4th of July weekend in at least 7 years. Police say a shooting on the city's west side early Sunday left six people, mostly teenagers, injured. Additionally, the Chicago Police Department says two officers were injured after being shot in the South Shore neighborhood. Through the first 6 months of the year, shootings and homicides in Chicago have been up slightly over last year's historic reduction, but still well below the pace of other recent years. An effort to increase transparency and accountability for the largest and most powerful artificial intelligence companies becomes law in Illinois. Governor J.B. Pritzker joined state officials and lawmakers in Chicago today to sign the Artificial Intelligence Safety Measures Act. Officials say the law requires developers to disclose safety practices, report significant safety incidents, and maintain compliance processes while providing independent oversight. Pritzker says states must step in to fill the regulatory void left by the federal government and take the lead on overseeing AI.
So where the federal government has been unwilling to step up, states must venture once more unto the breach. We must protect our people from the dangers of AI while still harnessing the unique potential of the technology.
The legislation passed with overwhelming bipartisan support in the General Assembly. The new law follows similar measures approved in New York and California late last year. Southside and South Suburban neighbors could see more flooding if one of the area's two largest deep tunnel reservoirs tops its capacity. The Metropolitan Water Reclamation District says the McCook and Thornton reservoirs are at 98% and 94% capacity, respectively. But the Thornton Reservoir, serving the South Side and 13 suburbs, is holding more than twice as much at 7.3 billion gallons of water. It is the fullest it's been since becoming operational in 2015. For the McCook Reservoir, that's the one you're seeing here, July 3rd was the sixth time this year that it's reached capacity. Some municipalities reported 8 to 10 inches of rainfall over the wet weekend, with more in the forecast later this week. More sad news for fans of the endangered piping plovers nesting at Montrose Beach. Another chick has died. Monitors say the chick, given the name Tweety, died over the holiday weekend, with weather conditions fluctuating between extreme heat and thunderstorms possibly playing a role. This comes after sibling Mavis died last week, just after the foursome were given names through a naming contest. Siblings Buddy and Frankie remain at the beach with their parents, Imani and Sea Rocket. The pair of endangered birds have nested at Montrose Beach for 3 years running. Up next, a look at what's in Congress's bipartisan housing bill. That's right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
The 21st Century Road to Housing Act is bipartisan legislation meant to make housing more affordable for Americans. It's already passed the U.S. House and Senate and is just awaiting approval from President Donald Trump. He, though, has so far refused to sign it, instead pushing for an unrelated voter ID bill called the Save America Act. The housing bill would automatically go into effect July 10th, even without the president's signature, or he could choose to veto it. To break down what the bill could potentially mean for Illinois residents, we are joined by David Doig, president of the Real Estate Development Group Chicago Neighborhood Initiatives. Jeff Smith, executive director of the Institute for Housing Studies at DePaul University. And Horacio Mendez, president and CEO of the Woodstock Institute. That's a nonprofit whose mission is to advance economic justice and racial equity within financial systems. Gentlemen, welcome back. Thanks for joining us. So let's start with the main provisions that are outlined in this bill. It would increase the housing supply by mandating that the Department of Housing and Urban Development offer guidance to local communities on how to reform zoning and land use policies that would help reduce barriers to housing development, provide grants and loans to support the development of new housing or the improvement of already existing properties, and increasing the limit for public welfare investment for certain banks. Jeff, to you first, do you think these provisions are a step in the right direction to fix the housing supply shortage?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one of the key factors of the housing crisis is lack of supply. I mean, we've tracked, you know, the mismatch between supply and demand since the Great Recession, and, you know, development stopped really around 15 years ago. As it recovered, you know, supply of housing didn't really recover in the same way. On top of that, the type of housing that's needed in terms of, you know, the changing demographics and whatnot have also created a mismatch of both supply and demand. So this bill certainly attempts to address that issue.
Horacio, what do you think of this legislation?
It's an attempt. It's being described as one of the most aggressive housing bills that we've seen in a long time, but I think that's simply because of the fact that the bar is really low. We haven't really had a federal housing bill here in decades since the improvement of the permanency of the low-income housing tax credit. So overall, it is constrained by what the federal government is limited and what it can and can't do with regard to supply and demand and housing. At the end of the day, it has to work through the local machinery of zoning, of building, of construction, of labor, of the willingness of neighbors to see their communities change. And that is a bit of a fragmented environment from which the federal government is hoping its nudges and the incentives that are in this bill might be able to overcome that. But that is yet to be seen. We'll have to wait and see.
So as we know, Chicago itself is in the midst of an affordable housing and supply crisis. David, what are the barriers that local developers face when building more housing developments?
Yeah, I think the major challenge right now is construction costs. And so if you look at the cost to build a new home, you're talking about, you know, anywhere from $400,000 to $600,000 a unit, while the, you know, the median home price is $400,000. And so you've got, as Jeff described, this mismatch between what it costs to build and what you can sell or rent for. And I think that's why you see prices going up, whether it's home prices or rents. It's a supply and demand issue. And we just, as a city, have not been building. Just a few data points. If you look at Chicago last year, the city permitted about 4,200 units across the entire city of new residential housing. This year, it's expected to be even lower than that. It'll be more in the $3,800 unit range. Whereas, you know, a Wall Street Journal article over the weekend, New York built 38,000 units of new housing last year. So 4,000 compared to 38,000.
New York City.
New York City, correct, built 38,000, and they're on pace to do that again this year.
So how does the city of Chicago counter that?
Well, I think the city's got to do a number of things. One is it's got to look at the cost to build, and a lot of it is regulatory. When you look at the cost of permits, the cost of hiring zoning attorneys, the cost of labor, all of those add into the cost of the home. The home builders estimate that 20% of housing costs are directly related to government regulation. And so you've got to find ways to strip down that regulation to drive down the cost.
Jeff, we know that a large portion, as we've said, a lot of the mismatch is between, you know, supply and demand, but that hasn't always been the case. How did we get here?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you go back to the Great Recession, you really saw that crisis affect demand for housing, which collapsed because the crisis was really driven by an economic crisis based in housing. You saw the mortgage lenders, the folks who finance housing, stop doing that because they were dealing with troubled portfolios. And you saw development stop as well because builders also were responding to that crisis. Once the market started to recover around 2012, you saw demand grow, but you didn't see supply grow with it. And then the pandemic hit, and that continued to kind of exacerbate that mismatch of supply and demand by new drivers related to preferences for where people wanted to live. exacerbated by interest rates and the fight against inflation, which locked in a lot of existing homeowners that prevented the regular turnover you might see in the housing market. So when you add these crises on top of each other and the various government interventions, you're creating this sort of ongoing crisis where the building and the development of the supply is really not matching the growing and the changing demand for housing in the Chicago nationally.
Orazio, you've said that we collectively need to start thinking about housing as a human right versus an asset or a commodity. How do we change that thinking, and what has that thinking done to the market so far?
Well, the challenge there, and one of the things that isn't said out loud very often, is the fact that people view their shelter as a commodity, as an asset. Therefore, there's an incentive to think about it in terms of how much is it worth and how much is it going to appreciate. So for those that already are blessed enough to be able to have a home, they have a singular focus of seeing the value of that home go up. Therefore, the mismatch between supply and demand works in their favor. All of a sudden, they have an appreciating asset, irrespective of whether or not it creates a problem where teachers of their kids can't afford to live there, policemen, firemen, others are driving to affordability an hour or 2 hours away from that neighborhood. So there needs to be a shift in mindset about what it means to actually have a community that's thriving. And think a little bit between the balance of, yes, your home is an asset, but is it really sort of like holding stock? No, it's not. It's much more important than that. So there needs to be much more of a community conversation about what's needed in terms of creating a healthy fabric, where, yes, you can experience some sort of shelter appreciation, but you can't view it as your retirement. You can't necessarily treat it as the tighter supply is, the better for me, but the worse for everybody else. That's just not something that we're ready to really have an honest conversation about. That can't be addressed through legislation, even though this country has a very long history of trying to legislate moral behavior. That's really something about values and what we feel we need to do as a member of a constructive and productive society.
Right, that would require sort of a whole shift of what we call the American dream, right, which is home ownership and being able to work to have that home. And okay, so let's do a little bit of math. Median price for a home in Chicago is $375,000. The income, as we've discussed, sort of like the mismatch in what it costs to build versus what it, what you can sell it for. The income needed to purchase a home of that amount is $95,000, and the median household income in Chicago, $77,000. David, what needs to happen to make home ownership attainable for middle-income residents?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of bringing those costs down. I think certainly the current interest rate environment isn't helping when you've got interest rates of 6-7%. But I think there also needs to be more creativity around the housing types that we're approaching. So things like manufactured housing, modular housing. We don't have the big home builders here in Cook County and in the city of Chicago. These are the people that are building America, and they're literally not in our city. And so we've got to find incentives to get national home builders that build at scale, that build at a pace that we don't have here in Chicago. So I think it's a combination of creating a lot more supply. When you create more supply, you push prices down, whether that's apartments, whether that's new homes. But we've got to be committed to driving more supply. And then I think we need creative models, whether that's relaxing the building code or thinking about different housing types. All of that's needed if we're going to see housing become more affordable again.
Jeff, if this Housing Act does go into effect, what kind of material changes might we see?
I mean, I think it'll probably take a while for anything to really manifest itself in terms of day-to-day affordability, because it requires, the bill to be enacted. Once it's enacted, it requires local governments to adopt changes to their building codes, zoning, et cetera. It requires builders to actually build stuff, that housing to hit the market, and then in the market to respond. So realistically, the timeline for it to actually affect the day-to-day house prices that we see are probably a few years down the line. But theoretically, it is addressing a kind of fundamental, foundational challenge that we need to address, which is building more housing. So in the big picture, it's probably worthwhile effort, but it may not be an immediate return.
Also going to require some patience. David, you're part of a group called Reclaiming Chicago. The goal is to build 1,000 new homes on the west side, 1,000 on the south side. Yep. In some cases, communities that have not seen that new construction in decades. How significant is it for a community like Roseland, for example, to see that development?
Yeah, I think there are three kind of key elements here. One is obviously creating affordable options for local residents. The second is building that generational wealth. With the racial wealth gap, can we begin to solve some of those issues around equity? And then finally, I would say one of the maybe underlooked is repopulation. I mean, in a place like Roseland, we've lost 60,000-70,000 people. We've got to bring back residents if we're going to have quality retail, if we're going to have quality schools, and build that kind of community that Horacio was talking about. So we've got to really focus on building new housing around affordability, density, and generational wealth building.
Sort of the chicken or the egg thing, right? Like if you build it, then you'll have people who will move into it. But
yeah, and that'll help your retail, that'll help your schools. Actually, crime goes down when neighborhoods repopulate. So all of these social issues, while not fundamental to housing, add to that kind of community.
There's been an effort, Horacio, in some municipalities across the U.S. to build more government housing. Mm-hmm. How could people benefit from the government getting involved in housing supply?
A lot of that has to do, I mean, it's a bit of an indictment of the private market, simply not being able to solve the problem. But it's also a bit of an indictment of government itself. When you insert politics into housing, usually good things don't happen. You may have a good idea, but it lasts for a political election cycle. And when you think about some of the best initiatives I've seen around the country, Envision Utah, which is a 50-year plan that started in the 1990s, Minneapolis 2040, which is equally a long-standing initiative which has already shown tremendous benefit in terms of development of housing. What they did was they actually tried to make it, I'm not sure if this is the right way of putting it, but politician-proof. So that way, somebody new that comes in as the mayor or the head of that area politically doesn't just discard it out of hand because it belonged to the previous administration. If it's a good idea 5 years ago, it's a good idea now.
The housing sits.
So as a result now, what you're seeing, though, are some municipalities that are taking this in the privately and really building it on their own.
Okay. All right. That's where we'll have to leave it. Thanks to the three of you for joining us, David Doig, Jeff Smith, and Horacio Mendez. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Up next, we revisit our conversation with the pioneering entrepreneur, George Johnson. Legendary Chicago entrepreneur George Johnson, a pioneer in the black hair care industry, died today at 99. His Johnson Products Company revolutionized the black hair care market with products like UltraWave and AfroSheen. Johnson founded the multi-million dollar company in 1954 on Chicago's South Side, and he continued to break racial barriers to become one of the most successful black entrepreneurs in the country by the late 1960s. He joined us last year, along with his co-writer, Hillary Beard, to talk about his book, AfroSheen, How I Revolutionized an Industry with the Golden Rule from Soul Train to Wall Street. We revisit that conversation tonight. What made you want to write this book now?
You sure you want to know?
I am sure.
Okay. I never intended to write a book. Never. I didn't like talking about myself. And every time I started talking about myself to my grandkids, tears would just flow. So I decided that I wasn't going to write a book. Friends asked me, and people who knew me asked me for 30 years, what am I going to tell my story? And I always told them I'm not going to do it because I don't like talking about myself. However, on November 21st, a Sunday morning, 2021, I was sitting in my family room, and all of a sudden, my room became occluded. I got warm. I tried to get up out of my chair. I couldn't get up out of my chair. And I clearly heard five words: you must tell your story. And I believed it was the Lord telling me that I had to tell my story. It scared me to death. And I immediately changed my mind 180 degrees and and decided to look for a professional writer.
And we know the rest is history, because we know that that clearly led you to Hillary Beard. But I want to back up into some of that story a little bit, because I imagine it was probably an emotional process for you if the tears were flowing when trying to express this to your kids. But you became a pioneer in the black hair care industry at a time when, of course, blacks were still facing all sorts of obstacles in this country, with segregation among them, chief among them. What led you to create those products at the time?
I got on the elevator on the fifth floor at Fuller Products Company, where I worked, and the elevator stopped on the third floor. Gentleman gets on, well-dressed, and I looked at him, and it blurted out of my mouth without thinking. I said, "What the hell is wrong with you?" And he told me that he came to Fuller Products because it was a black company, and that he needed some help, and he asked Mr. Fuller to make him a better product. But he's having trouble with the product he was using in his barbershop. His name was Orville Nelson, and he was owner of the House of Nelson. And Mr. Fuller told him that he was not interested in barber business, didn't have any time to be involved with it. He had too much of his own things going. And so I said to him, "I don't know what you're talking about, but I work in the lab. And if you have a card, give me your card. And I'll come by and see if I can do something for you." So I told him I'd help him. And that was the beginning of this of Johnson Products Company.
Okay. Hillary, you helped chronicle nearly, a century of history that is Mr. Johnson's life. What drew you to this project, and what was it like?
Well, I received a call out of nowhere, which I also viewed as a gift from God. There's an African proverb that says, when an elder dies, it's like a library burned down. And here was this very much alive 94-year-old elder who was incredibly accomplished, a trailblazer, a pioneer, with a library of stories that had not been documented, and also black history that has not been documented, and some of which has been actively suppressed. So I felt two responsibilities. One, he's 94, so we needed to move quickly to reflect, remember, catalog, and condense all these memories into a book quickly. And then secondly, we wanted to contextualize it in history so that today's leaders, visionaries, strivers, and entrepreneurs can understand the magnitude of his accomplishments within the history and the times within which they took place, which are eerily similar to what's happening now.
Mr. Johnson, in the book, it's included in the title, how you revolutionized an industry with the Golden Rule, something that you have lived by. How has the Golden Rule, treating others as you would want to be treated, how has that guided your life?
It has made me what I am and what I've been. The Golden Rule is grounded in love, and trying to love people. You can't miss being, first of all, you help them, and they help you. I came upon that. I was taught that. I was taught that by Mr. Fuller. I worked for Mr. Fuller from the time I was 17 years old until I was 24. Well, actually, 24. And Mr. Fuller was a very devout man and a good businessman, and he lived by the Golden Rule. He was my mentor, and his encouragement, looking at what he did and what it did for him, I decided, that's how I'm going to try to live. And I tried to live it in my life and in my business.
Hillary, when Afro-Sheen came onto the market, black hair care industry was not as big as it is today, which is a multi-billion dollar industry, and black people didn't have a lot of options with regards to their hair care. Was Mr. Johnson ahead of his time?
Mr. Johnson was a pioneer, and the creation of UltraSheen Relaxer, which was the first product that allowed African-American women to permanently straighten their hair. It allowed them to access the mainstream labor market in ways that they had been unable to access before. So it was revolutionary in opening those opportunities up to black women at a time when we were excluded oftentimes from mainstream jobs and often not seen as human. In part because of the texture of our hair. He was a pioneer in terms of hiring people within the city of Chicago. He hired a diverse workforce before anybody did. He had a loving work environment. He offered above market wages to African Americans. He offered jobs to African Americans, to all people of color and women, from the factory floor to the C-suite before that was done. He offered profit sharing to everybody in the company way before that was an industry norm. He had health care benefits and on-site health care available, tuition reimbursement, maternity leave, benefits that people still want today. Mr. Johnson was offering in the 1960s and 70s.
What do you hope people take away from your life story?
Help one another.
All right, that is a good lesson. I think I'm going to have to leave it there. Congrats on the book to both of you. Thanks again for joining us, George Johnson and Hillary Beard. Thank you.
Reflecting the people and perspectives that make up our communities, this story is part of Chicago Tonight, Black Voices.
And that's our show for this Monday night. Stay connected with our reporters and what they're working on by following us on Instagram at WTTW Chicago. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and at 10:30. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a personal injury law firm working to preserve the dignity and rights of all individuals.